Chapter 5. AIDS, the virus hunters converge. Had the AIDS epidemic struck years earlier, so goes the common belief, medical science would have been unprepared to deal with the crisis. In what would seem to be an amazing coincidence, the crucial technology for confronting this plague emerged just as the first AIDS cases were being documented in the early 1980s. The ability to grow and measure T cells, a central component of the body's immune system, arrived in the nick of time to see AIDS patients losing their T cells. The technique for detecting and isolating retroviruses had just evolved to the point that the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, could be found. And a huge, well-financed establishment of scientific research teams had been set up, ready to gather vast quantities of data on any new disease. Dozens of new biotech companies mushroomed just in time to mass-produce HIV tests, HIV vaccines, and antiviral drugs. But the construction of AIDS as a contagious disease caused by a virus had little to do with science and even less to do with luck. Was the NIH's apparent preparedness for the epidemic an accident? Asked Edward Shorter in his 1987 book, The Health Century. No, he concluded, it resulted from the enormous funding of science in preceding years. Shorter hardly knew how right he was. Virus hunters were coasting on their laurels ever since they had won the war on polio, but they had failed to produce any public health benefit in their 15-year-old war on cancer despite enormous funding and enormous technology. They needed a success because their lease on public support extended for a few years by the war on cancer was wearing. Using their new technology, the virus hunters could now find whatever they wanted in terms of slow, latent, or defective viruses. When AIDS appeared, the tumor virologists who could not find a tumor virus were poised to take full advantage of the situation to at least find an AIDS virus. The NIH, however, did not lead the charge against this new syndrome in the early 1980s. Many scientists at first refused to believe it existed. Virus hunters had more experience searching for viruses in older, better recognized diseases such as hepatitis or cancer. The overfunded science bureaucracy was too cumbersome to exploit such a new phenomenon before most people had even heard of it. The NIH proved more effective in mobilizing the scientific community behind a virus hunt and crushing all opposition only after AIDS had been widely sold as a pandemic threat. This new syndrome also had little chance of exciting the lay public. Since it was found mostly in male homosexuals and heroin addicts, it was too obscure to concern the average heterosexual person preoccupied with career and family. Even among homosexuals, AIDS was at first denied as an obstacle to their sexual freedom. Yet against all the odds, AIDS launched a bandwagon almost overnight. Less than 2 years after the first five cases were identified, the syndrome officially became the federal government's top health priority. By then, the virus hunters had already elbowed past each other to find a viral culprit, and HIV was just being discovered. How could this epidemic have mushroomed into a virus-hunting bonanza so rapidly? The answer lies in a parallel branch of biomedicine, public health. To understand this movement's role in blaming AIDS on a virus, one must first understand its history. Public health seeks to prevent disease rather than treat it, and is based on the notion that a healthy lifestyle is not just a matter of personal responsibility, but also a government management imperative. Unlike the academic style of research scientists, public health professionals take a more activist approach to disease quarantining individuals or populations, seizing control of food and water supplies, conducting mass immunizations, pushing slogans in health campaigns, running aggressive family planning programs, regulating or restricting access to items ranging from cigarettes to dietary supplements, or otherwise targeting anything they believe is a risk factor for disease. Public health experts are inclined to view almost any infectious disease as an emergency. The federal government officially adopted such a system in 1912 with the reorganization of the Public Health Service, PHS, headed by the Surgeon General. Based largely on the German model, PHS members formed a corps of commissioned officers, complete with uniforms that dispatched teams to impose quarantines and other crisis control measures on cities with contagious epidemics. The National Institutes of Health, one branch of the PHS, became its center for biomedical research. Though originally responding to requests from state governments for epidemic control, the NIH always felt more at home with laboratory research. When James Shannon restructured the NIH in the 1950s to centralize its role in basic science, the agency finally left public health activism altogether. Its heir had already been born during World War II. In early 1942, anticipating outbreaks of malaria like those in World War I, the Public Health Service established a special unit called Malaria Control in War Areas, MCWA. Its primary mission was to prevent spread of the disease among the hundreds of military bases throughout the southern United States, which MCWA accomplished mostly by using pesticides like DDT to kill malaria-carrying mosquitoes. The creators of the MCWA clearly anticipated their own obsolescence following the end of the Second World War. Within weeks of U.S. entry into the war and before the Surgeon General had officially established MCWA, its soon-to-be leaders were already discussing their long-term prospects. Justin Andrews and Lewis Williams, two of the agency's founders, entertained visions of public health management on a national scale, which they preferred over the disbanding of MCWA. So by the time the war was ending in 1945, these MCWA officials convinced Congress to extend their authority to include civilian malaria control. While not terribly glamorous, the new work kept the program alive. The PHS reorganized the MCWA in 1946, creating the Permanent Communicable Disease Center, CDC, based in Atlanta, Georgia. The name has been changed several times since 1967, though the initials have remained nearly constant. It is now called the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This new agency absorbed all remaining public health activities of the NIH. The CDC enthusiastically responded to all calls for help from states experiencing disease epidemics of various kinds. While malaria remained the focus of CDC energies, its resources were stretched to branch into new diseases, such as rabies and typhus, and even tapeworms. But the CDC wanted to assume full control over the nation's public health system, rather than being regulated to serving state and local health departments on request. At the same time, their disease control mission was increasingly being regarded as obsolete, prompting serious discussions about abolishing the CDC altogether. The situation changed in 1949 when the CDC brought on board Alexander Langmuir, an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins University School of Hygiene and Public Health. Langmuir was the CDC's first VIP, bringing with him both his expertise in epidemiology, the statistical study of epidemics, and his high-level connections, including his security clearance as one of the few scientists privy to the Defense Department's biological warfare program. Like the rest of the CDC, he hoped to empower the agency to monitor and exert authority over all epidemics throughout the nation. His dream might have stood little chance of materializing in an age of vanishing infectious disease, but because civil defense ranked high in government priorities at that time, officials of the PHS listened when Langmuir proposed that the CDC develop a comprehensive disease surveillance system to detect the earliest signs of a biological warfare attack. Such an infrastructure could also serve to control hypothetical epidemics using such techniques as quarantine measures and mass immunizations. By the start of the Korean War, Langmuir had talked public health officials and Congress into giving the CDC contingent powers to deal with potential emergencies. He shut down the malaria project, freeing millions of dollars to create a special new division of the CDC. In July of 1951, he assembled the first class of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, EIS, composed of 23 young medical or public health graduates. After 6 weeks of intensive epidemiological training, these EIS officers were assigned for 2 years to hospitals or state and local health departments around the country. Upon completing their field experience, EIS alumni were free to pursue any career they desired on the assumption that their loyalties would remain with the CDC and that they would permanently act as its eyes and ears. The focus of this elite unit was on activism rather than research and was expressed in its symbol, a shoe sole worn through with a hole. According to British epidemiologist Gordon Stewart, a former CDC consultant, the EIS was nicknamed the Medical CIA. Every summer since 1951, a new class of carefully chosen EIS recruits has been trained, some classes exceeding 100 people in size. Although a complete list of EIS officers and alumni was available until the spring of 1993, its members rarely advertised their affiliation. Now the membership directory has been withdrawn from public circulation. Over the past four decades, 2,000 EIS trainees reached key positions throughout this country and the world. Many work in the CDC itself, others in various agencies of the federal government. One of the original 1951 graduates, William Stewart, went on to become the Surgeon General of the United States during the late 1960s. Some have staffed the World Health Organization, WHO, including Jonathan Mann and Michael Merson, the two directors of WHO's Global Program on AIDS, while their fellow agents can be found in the health departments of foreign nations. Several dozen have entered university public health programs as teachers and researchers. Roughly 150 have taken jobs in state or local health departments, closely watching every outbreak of disease. Hundreds have become private practice doctors, dentists, or even veterinarians, while others work in hospitals. Some have joined biotechnology or pharmaceutical companies, or have risen in the ranks of major insurance corporations. Some reside within tax-exempt foundations, helping direct the spending of trust funds on medical projects. A few have obtained prominent positions in the media. Lawrence Altman became a medical journalist for the New York Times in 1969 and is now its head medical writer. Bruce Dan joined ABC News as its Chicago medical editor for 6 years, beginning in 1984. The same year, he became a senior editor of the influential Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, a position he held for 9 years. JAMA regularly publishes a section written by the CDC. Marvin Turk has held the title of editor at the University of Washington's Journal of Infectious Diseases since 1988. These three men were recruited into the EIS in 1963, 1979, and 1960, respectively, each 1 year before he entered the media. Regardless of which career paths EIS alumni take, the vast majority of them retain their contacts with the CDC. Not only do they constitute an informal surveillance network, but they can act as unrecognized advocates for the CDC point of view, whether as media journalists or as prominent physicians. And they serve as a reservoir of trained personnel for any CDC-defined emergency. As Lang Muir himself described it in 1952, "One of the primary purposes of the Epidemic Intelligence Services of CDC is to recruit and train such a core of epidemiologists. As a result of their experience, many of these officers may well remain in full-time epidemiology or other public health pursuits at federal, state, or local levels. Some no doubt will return to civilian academic or clinical practice, but in the event of war, they could be returned to active duty with the public health service and assigned strategic areas to fulfill the functions for which they were trained." The EIS network has functioned very much as Lang Muir first envisioned, except that it has grown up in the post-contagion industrial world, where infectious diseases have largely become subject matter for historians. The awaited biological attack never arrived. The CDC has nevertheless continued to exploit public trust by transforming seasonal flus and other minor epidemics into monstrous crises and by manufacturing contagious plagues out of non-infectious medical conditions. Searching for epidemics. During the decades after its founding, the CDC searched for authentic public health emergencies. Tuberculosis was no longer the scourge of industrial nations. Measles had largely stopped taking lives, and other potentially fatal diseases, ranging from diphtheria to pneumonia, ceased striking fear in the hearts of the public. Only polio was left, and by the 1960s it too basically vanished. In identifying epidemics, then, the CDC was forced to attend to continually smaller outbreaks of disease. Before long, experts began defining contagious epidemics on the basis of disease clusters. Almost any coincidence of two or more closely spaced persons contracting the same disease could qualify as an incipient epidemic, even if they occurred weeks or months apart. Clustered outbreaks, however, provide no conclusive evidence of an infectious disease. When the bacteria hunters sought to blame scurvy, pellagra, and other vitamin deficiency diseases on microbes, they mistakenly cited clusters of sick people to argue the diseases were spreading. Likewise, the virus hunters pointed to clusters to support their indictment of viruses for SMON and other non-contagious diseases. Clustering actually reveals very little information. It can reflect several people sharing the same diet, behavior, or environmental hazard of almost any kind, not just common exposure to a germ. Even in cases of truly infectious disease, clusters may only indicate a group of people is susceptible to a sickness for similar reasons, while other people infected by the same microbe will remain healthy. In other words, no epidemic will ensue. If anything, epidemiologists have classically studied clusters of sick people as clues to subtle environmental hazards, not infectious agents. But when public health officials issue ominous warnings about mysterious disease outbreaks, they terrify the public with visions of deadly pandemics. The most recent examples include the premature panics generated by an eminent hantavirus epidemic in the United States in 1994. The hantavirus presumably had jumped species from mice to American Navajo Indians. But after killing just a few, the virus made peace with the Indians and apparently retired to its mouse reservoir. The epidemic failed to materialize. A front-page article in the San Francisco Chronicle reported that CDC epidemiologists, shown in spacesuits across the nation, are carefully monitoring the deer mouse population and the level of virus within it. But all that was left to discover of the former Navajo flu by the CDC epidemiologists in their spacesuits were healthy mice in the mountains of California. In May 1995, the CDC rang the alarm once again, this time threatening with an imminent Ebola virus pandemic. The deadly killer virus was expected to leave its hidden reservoir in the rainforests of Africa to claim Europe and the United States. The article in Time magazine was peppered with CDC sleuths in spacesuits and color electron micrographs of the virus, although the electron microscope cannot take color pictures and no virus is colored. A CDC virologist suggested the virus could leave the rainforest if we get a virus that is both deadly to man and transmitted in the air. A European epidemiologist who heads the United Nations AIDS program echoed the CDC's alarm warning. It's theoretically feasible that an infected person from Kikwit could go to Kinshasa, get on a plane to New York, fall ill, and present transmission risk there. But within a month, the epidemic had faded away in Africa, and not a single Ebola case was reported in the United States or Europe. A month later, the CDC was once again sounding the alarm. In an article entitled, "After AIDS, Superbugs Give Medicine the Jitters," the public was warned of an impending crisis in the form of superbugs. Superbugs are strains of bacteria said to be highly resistant to antibiotics. As usual, the CDC issued its warnings in the form of a chorus of conforming voices recruited from within and without the agency. Robert Shope, professor of epidemiology at Yale, warned, "If we don't gear up to bring matters under control, we could face a new crisis similar to the AIDS epidemic or the influenza epidemic that killed 20 million people worldwide in 1918 and 1919. Ruth Berkelman, deputy director at the CDC, resounded, "If we continue to let this get out of hand, we're setting ourselves up for a major catastrophe. I'm talking about going in for a routine operation and dying from an infection." Most people have no idea of the more than 1,000 outbreaks of disease each year, including colds, seasonal flus, hepatitis, and numerous non-infectious syndromes, all running their course and disappearing, often despite remaining unexplained by scientists. They are natural coincidences between immunodeficiency acquired by some non-contagious risk factors like drugs and infectious by any one of the ubiquitous microbes termed opportunistic infections. But these many outbreaks provide the CDC with its inexhaustible source of epidemics. The first genuine success of the CDC emerged from the polio epidemic. Ironically, it was the vaccine against polio, not the disease itself, that provided the opportunity. The Salk vaccine was entering its large-scale testing phase in 1954, and Alexander Langmuir wanted a piece of the action for his fledgling EIS. Insisting on CDC participation in the field trials, Langmuir was able to assign EIS officers around the country to monitor newly immunized children. The EIS aggressively followed up the first cases of vaccine-induced polio appearing in the spring of 1955 by ultimately uncovering the hundreds of victims who then received national attention over the next several months. The findings of the EIS investigation led to the suspension of the Salk vaccine and to the political shakeup at the NIH that brought James Shannon to power. Although this incident involved neither a natural epidemic nor biological warfare, it built the CDC's reputation as an efficient surveillance agency. The next major CDC initiative ended less spectacularly, yet the agency emerged untarnished. The spring of 1957 brought news of a flu sweeping nations of the Far East. Influenza is generally a rather benign disease, but CDC officials exploited memories of the deadly 1918 flu epidemic that returned with U.S. soldiers from Europe and killed nearly 500,000 people. The decision to predict a deadly flu epidemic was arbitrary, considering that 39 flu seasons had since gone by without disaster. Ignoring the fact that circumstances in 1918 differed radically from 1957, the CDC rang the alarm over an imminent Asian flu epidemic. A frightened nation quickly jumped into line. Congress gave Eisenhower $500,000, a large sum at the time, into which Langmuir dipped to expand the ranks of the EIS. Seasonal flu did arrive by summer and continued spreading until the following winter. As soon as the epidemic began slowing, public health officers rushed to issue warnings of a second round. In the end, the CDC and other agencies accomplished little or nothing to slow the epidemic. Large numbers of vaccine doses were crash-produced, mostly after the flu season had finished. The flu itself was probably no worse than in any other year, but the heightened surveillance of the disease, together with the frantic public warnings, helped feed the false impression of a particularly horrible epidemic. Several leading public health experts openly criticized the overhyped flu scare, and some of them suggested the whole incident merely helped stimulate vaccine sales. But the CDC came out ahead anyway as a heroic group, having gained public acceptance for mass immunization on command. Since the Asian flu, the CDC has regularly produced vaccines of unproven effectiveness for each new flu season and has maintained a permanent flu surveillance program. With its political standing secured, the CDC began expanding its reach into virtually any disease over which it could gain authority. Collaborations with other biomedical institutions often worked to promote both parties. One such arrangement directly fueled the virus cancer program. During the early 1960s, EIS personnel were assigned to investigate every cluster of leukemia cases reported anywhere in the country and to search for a virus on the assumption leukemia was infectious. The efforts amounted to little more than a wild goose chase, but in medical circles, the repetitive publicity surrounding these random clusters drummed into every scientist's head the notion that viruses must cause cancer. Most researchers, after all, had readily accepted the belief that clustering somehow proved a disease to be contagious. The National Cancer Institute backed this EIS project enthusiastically, and it ultimately benefited through the extra funding it received for chasing cancer viruses. Robert Gallo was one of the young scientists powerfully influenced by such thinking. Until the advent of AIDS, however, the CDC's most ambitious program and its most embarrassing disaster played itself out in 1976. By that time, the EIS network of officers and alumni had so widely penetrated hospitals, health departments, and other institutions that potentially any minor disease outbreak could easily be detected. In January 1976, five soldiers at Fort Dix in New Jersey contracted a flu. One of them died after overexerting himself against doctor's orders. Such a minor episode met the CDC criteria for a cluster, and the agency sprang into action. Since 1966, the CDC director had been David Spencer, a medical doctor by training who had experience in various research, public health, and administrative jobs, and who had just received an honorary membership to the EIS in 1975. Spencer used a local flu outbreak at Fort Dix as an opportunity to replay the Asian flu public relations victory of 1957, only on a larger scale. Relying on historical precedent, Spencer declared an imminent flu epidemic that would rival the deadly plague of 1918. But what Spencer failed to understand was that Americans in 1976 were much less vulnerable to infectious disease as opposed to the undernourished, immunodeficient people at the end of World War I. The new epidemic was nicknamed swine flu, based on the belief that pigs were the reservoir for this human virus. Spencer placed the EIS network on full alert to monitor for cases of swine flu. The large Auditorium A, located in CDC headquarters in Atlanta, became the command center called the War Room. set up especially for this occasion. It contained banks of telephones, teleprinters, and computers, the hardware for an unprecedented monitoring system which, to work, also required a typing pool, photocopy machines, and doctors sitting at rows of desks in the center of the room. Experts worked around the clock, week after week, chasing down every rumor of flu clusters. Spencer officially called for the most aggressive emergency immunization crusade in history to be conducted before the flu season arrived. Congress initially favored the idea, not understanding the CDC's bias for infectious epidemics. The naive legislators easily could be manipulated by the CDC's alarmist rhetoric. President Ford appointed a committee that met within 2 days of Spencer's vaccination proposal and decided to back Spencer's plan, which would run up costs into the hundreds of millions of dollars. The air of panic spread rapidly. Minutes after the meeting ended, President Ford appeared on national television and called for the vaccination against swine flu of every man, woman, and child in the United States. The plan gained momentum despite the fact that even the massive EIS surveillance program could not find any more cases of swine flu. But when early testing showed that the vaccine produced side effects in 20% to 40% of inoculated people and potentially deadly reactions such as high fevers in 1% to 5%, insurance companies backed away from supporting the program. With no insurance coverage, Congress became nervous and also began retreating before the plan came up for a vote. Now Spencer faced serious trouble, his whole reputation standing on the line. No longer able to back out quietly, he chose instead to push more aggressively. The word went out to the EIS network to pursue actively any flu-like illness whatsoever. Spencer had to convince Congress that the swine flu epidemic was real. Meanwhile, another CDC official took note of the swine flu alert. By early July 1976, David Frazier, MD, hoped that a suitable epidemic would soon appear in the United States. His definition of suitable was quite specific. The outbreak would have no known cause. It could present a serious threat to human life and might even have claimed some victims, thus providing the corpses for all important tissue samples. With every day that passed, his need for that epidemic grew more urgent. He cast his net wide for news that somewhere between Alaska and the Mexican border, a mysterious malady had surfaced. He made sure he was never far from a telephone. Frazier was the head of the Special Pathogens Branch of the CDC, the section charged with investigating infectious diseases with unknown causes. He had been an EIS member since 1971, and he was awaiting two new EIS trainees who would shortly be assigned to his office. He wanted to give them field experience through managing a real epidemic. With the EIS on full alert, a suitable epidemic was likely to be found on short order. Selectable from the 1,000 or more disease outbreaks occurring each year in this country. The first suitable choice presented itself in Philadelphia days after American Legion members had returned home from their July convention. On Monday morning, August 2nd, after receiving word of a few pneumonia cases, personnel in the CDC's swine flu war room established contact with Jim Beecham, a brand new EIS officer barely settling down to his assignment in the Philadelphia Health Department. The CDC could not directly intervene in the situation without an invitation, and Beecham helped arrange one immediately. Within hours, three EIS officers flew to Philadelphia. They were joined by David Frazier the next morning, followed within days by a team of dozens of CDC experts. State and local health departments had been willing to accept EIS officers on temporary assignment because of their qualifications and training. But as Philadelphia health officials now discovered, this amounted to a Faustian pact. When the CDC personnel arrived, pre-positioned EIS members such as Beecham and top health advisor Robert Sherrar stopped obeying local authorities and began following orders from the incoming CDC team. Local officials became helpless to stop the tide of events. The CDC seized the initiative, fomenting rumors that this Legionnaire's disease was the beginning of the swine flu pandemic. The media proved cooperative. The New York Times assigned none other than EIS alumnus Lawrence Altman to cover the story. With nationwide hysteria rapidly developing, Congress suddenly changed its collective opinion on the swine flu bill, pulling it out of committee and passing the legislation within days. By the time the CDC team officially acknowledged that Legionnaire's disease was not swine flu after all, President Ford had already signed the vaccine bill into law. David Frazier continued managing the CDC investigation for a few more weeks, allowing his new EIS people plenty of training. After testing the patients for infection by a variety of germs, the CDC experts found nothing consistent and packed their bags to leave. The case was declared unresolved and effectively dropped, leaving Philadelphia officials to pick up the pieces. This cavalier treatment and the one-track focus on infectious microbes so enraged New York Congressman John Murphy that he held hearings on Legionnaires' disease in November. Calling CDC officials to testify on their fiasco, Murphy humiliated the agency for not having found the epidemic's cause and for ignoring the possibility of non-contagious or toxic causes. The CDC, for example, did not have a toxicologist present in their initial team of investigators sent to deal with the swine flu epidemic, he fumed at the meetings. No apparent precautions were taken to deal with the possibility, however remote at the time, that something else might have been the cause. Likely smarting from the attack, David Frazier returned to Atlanta and put laboratory experts to work on the tissue samples collected from Philadelphia. Frazier's own area of expertise lay in bacteria, not viruses, and the researchers under his supervision searched hard for bacteria. Within a few weeks, they found one, a harmless microbe that inhabits soil as well as plumbing in most buildings. Even though the bacterium fails Koch's postulates for causing disease, the CDC cleared its reputation and convinced the unsuspecting public it had discovered the cause of Legionnaires' disease. In the process, the CDC created a whole field of study devoted to this bacterium, which now employs a respectable number of scientists. The swine flu program, on the other hand, collapsed and could not be salvaged. Millions of people received the vaccine starting in October, although many were not told of the possible side effects. Soon, reports of hundreds of cases of paralysis began pouring in, ultimately including at least 600 cases and 74 deaths. The CDC attempted to classify the victims as having died of other diseases. Ultimately, the vaccine side effects could no longer be hidden, and the expensive scandal cost David Spencer his job as CDC chief. Ironically, the swine flu epidemic itself never materialized. Only the CDC's immunization program caused sickness and death. Allegheny County Coroner Cyril H. Wecht personally investigated some of the vaccine's most unfortunate victims, including several fatalities. In a stinging indictment of this CDC program, he wrote in 1978, "The government should limit itself to facilitating public programs. Employing high-pressure sales tactics like Madison Avenue mass media promoters to push a program is not commensurate with this objective. Certainly when people's lives are at stake, cheap politics has no place." Inventing AIDS. In the aftermath of the swine flu and Legionnaires' disease fiascos, the CDC diversified into other areas of public health, ones not always tied to infectious disease. In 1980, the agency was restructured into several units, each focusing on different issues, and as a whole was renamed to the plural, the Centers for Disease Control. But as the CDC grew, it still preferred contagious diseases as subjects of investigation. The NIH was likewise beginning to enter uncertain times, particularly as the war on cancer was dragging on without any tangible results. The virus hunters had consolidated their position with their so-called cancer viruses, but none had made enough of a public impression to justify their lavish funding. Public patience was beginning to wear thin, and even many scientists were growing critical. Both the CDC and the NIH, representing the public health and biomedical research establishments, needed a new war to revitalize themselves. Contagious epidemics had proven the most effective at mobilizing public interest, and the medical and health establishments had spent vast sums of money establishing themselves on microbe-hunting foundations. Yet microbe chasers had exhausted their opportunities with virtually every major disease, from hepatitis to cancer and more. Now they had no clear direction in which to march, no significant diseases to conquer. The virus hunters were heavily armed soldiers without a war to fight. Stated Red Cross official Paul Cumming in 1983, "The CDC increasingly needs a major epidemic to justify its existence." The AIDS epidemic became their salvation. Here was a brand new plague, too dauntingly unfamiliar to allow criticism of virus-hunting habits and growing quickly enough to compel urgent action. It was an epidemic that allowed no time to think, only to act. The inherent danger of an infectious disease would quickly unite responsible healthcare workers, scientists, and journalists to stem the possible danger to the health of the general population. Once recognized and taken seriously, it could easily be exploited by the virus hunters of the huge NIH-funded research establishment. But to identify the syndrome and label it contagious, the CDC and its EIS would first have to stake their claim. That opportunity arrived late in 1980. Michael Gottlieb, a young researcher at the Medical Center of the University of California, Los Angeles, wanted to study the immune system and began scouring the hospital for patients with immune deficiency diseases. By November, Gottlieb was introduced to one such case. The patient, who suffered from a yeast infection that had taken hold in his throat, also had a rare pneumonia that refused to go away. The pneumocystis carinii microbe that caused the pneumonia was known to inhabit the lungs of almost every human on the planet. The disease rarely struck anyone but cancer patients whose chemotherapy treatments would destroy their immune systems and leave them vulnerable to such normally benign germs. But this young man, in his early 30s, was taking no such therapy. Given his age, he should have been a specimen of perfect health. In any case, this was Gottlieb's chance to try out the brand new technology for counting T cells, one subset of white blood cells that participate in the immune system. The patient turned out to have very few T cells at all, much to Gottlieb's amazement. On the other hand, scientists knew very little about what a normal level of T cells should be, or any other white blood cells for that matter. The next several months of searching gathered three more such cases of immune deficiencies. All three displayed the same candidiasis, or yeast infection, as well as the pneumocystis pneumonia. And they all had low T-cell counts, the only parameter Gottlieb was interested in testing. By April of 1981, he decided he had a new syndrome on his hands. He called up the local public health department to ask for data on any similar patients elsewhere in Los Angeles. The staffer he spoke with, Wayne Shandera, was an active EIS officer trained the previous year. Shandera perked up at the news and found one more such case to add to the list. Now a pattern was emerging. All five men were active homosexuals. Gottlieb knew precisely what this discovery could mean for his career. As Randy Schiltz recorded in his 1987 book, And the Band Played On, Gottlieb phoned the New England Journal of Medicine. "I've got something here that's bigger than Legionnaires," he said. "What's the shortest time between submission and publication?" The journal refused to bend traditional rules of publication. Frustrated and impatient, Gottlieb turned again to Shandera, who contacted the CDC. He figured this was probably the sort of outbreak that the CDC would be only too happy to publicize without delay. Shandera was right. James Curran, an official in the Venereal Disease Division of the CDC, wrote, hot stuff, on the announcement and hurried it into press with the agency's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report. Like Gottlieb, CDC leaders could see the political benefits of managing another epidemic on the scale of Legionnaires' disease. On June 5th, the report was published, written so as to imply that these five unexplained cases spelled a major new disease. Despite the fact that the five victims had no contacts with each other, the report wasted no time suggesting that this might be a disease acquired through sexual contact. Buried in Gottlieb's paper was another common risk factor that linked the five patients much more specifically than sex. All five had reported the use of recreational drugs, specifically nitrite inhalants. Sex, being 3 billion years old, is not specific to any one group and is hardly a plausible source for a new disease. Once Gottlieb's paper was published, new cases were reported to the CDC, some of whom suffered the rare blood vessel tumor known as Kaposi sarcoma. The CDC immediately set up a special task force called Kaposi Sarcoma and Opportunistic Infections, KSOI, to find the cause of this syndrome. All of the known patients had been active male homosexuals who reported using poppers, the volatile nitrate liquid that had become the rage in the homosexual community for its ability to facilitate anal intercourse, as well as to maintain erections and prolong orgasms. This drug presented itself as the most specific explanation, especially given its known biochemical toxicity. But CDC experts had bigger plans for this illness, which could mobilize public concern only if it were believed to be infectious and therefore a threat to the entire population. The microbe-hunting bias of the KSOI task force was set in stone through its composition. Of the dozen or so members, its three leaders came from the venereal diseases section of the CDC, including two EIS officers, Harold Jaffe and Mary Ginnon, and James Curran, who became the group chair. Other members specialized in studying viruses or infectious parasites.